Quick warning before we get into the celebrations. There can be some swear words and adult concepts in these episodes, so make sure there's no kids around and maybe pop on some headphones. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Rights for Women Book Launch Podcast. I'm Pamela Cook, author, podcaster, and writing coach and mentor. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is a story about an orphan child, a lifelong friendship, and an impossible promise, now available at online retailers and through my website at pamelacook.com.au.
And I'm Kel from Rights for Women, the other half. I'm a podcaster and wannabe author. My business is Listen Up Podcasting, and we make podcasts for a positive world, like this one. You can find me at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or catch me on Facebook or Twitter.
As many of you will know, with the advent of coronavirus and lockdowns, authors with new releases have been unable to promote their books at live events. Here at Rights for Women, we want to help authors celebrate their new releases and help readers discover new books, all of which are available online at retailers and through independent bookstores. We'll be releasing these mini-sode chats with authors regularly throughout the coming months while we're all in isolation, and authors need a place to launch their books.
Please share the love by letting your reading friends know about the podcast and the books on social media, and by reviewing any books you read to help authors get the word out. This is a great time to put some new books on your shelf, virtual and physical, and to share the gift of reading.
Hi there, I'm Catherine Firkin. I am the author of Sticks and Stones. It's my debut crime thriller set in Melbourne. And here's the prologue. He woke with a start as the final siren was sounding. Wiping his mouth where sticky, malodorous drool had pooled around his lips, he squinted, trying to make out the score, which appeared far too small in the bottom left of the screen. He found the remote, wedged between the two couch cushions, and turned up the volume, happy to hear the anthem of the St Kilda Football Club blaring out triumphantly. But something wasn't right. He looked at the remote again, noticing the dark red smear across the buttons. He inspected his hands, where freshly dug scratches hid beneath congealed blood. Sighing, he shook his head. If he hadn't known it was impossible, he would have sworn he'd just heard his mother laughing. Standing up, his feet led him to the bathroom, the familiar white door opening as if of its own accord. Flicking the light switch, he kept his gaze firmly ahead, not allowing himself to look to the left to the bathtub where he knew she lay. He shuffled forward. The mirror above the basin was damaged, cracked in the bottom right. It had been that way for as long as he could remember. This, combined with the effects of years of splattered toothpaste and general grime, gave his face a distorted, ashen appearance, as though his reflection was shielded by a film of grey. He turned a tap, the old plumbing squeaking before the water spluttered out in sharp, uneven bursts. Scrubbing the blood off his hands, he meticulously inspected each finger, each nail, before patting his palms on his trousers. Drawing a long, slow breath, he finally turned around, allowing himself to inspect his handiwork. She was curled up over the drain, her empty gaze staring vacantly at the old showerhead. He grinned, looking into her wide pupils as he knelt down beside the tub. She'd understood why he'd had to do this. She'd remembered. He closed his eyes, inhaling the smell of blood, sweat, and fear. Justice. Reaching in, he carefully unwound the silver knot from her neck, the wire hanging in coils at her chest, rather like curling ribbon on a birthday present. Then he carefully began undressing her, slipping the ugly woolen jacket from her shoulders and unzipping the dress underneath. Humming, he tugged at her suede boots. It was so perfect and silent now, with just the odd drip from the tap at the sink. Returning to the damaged mirror, he pried it open, revealing a small cabinet behind the glass. From the top shelf, he retrieved his pocket knife. He knelt back down and smiled at the woman. It was time to leave his mark.
Oh, that's really quite chilling for an opening.
Yeah, I've been told people seem quite captivated from the moment they read that, which is great.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what you want for a crime thriller. So Sticks and Stones is your debut novel, Catherine?
Yes, it is. It's been something that I've been working on it for the past 5 years or so. Of course, I never imagined it would come out in the middle of a global pandemic, but there we go. That's life.
That's right. Yeah, everything's unexpected this year, isn't it? Good old 2020.
Yes, so it sure is.
Could you tell us a little about how you sort of ended up being a novelist? Your background is in journalism.
That's right. So I've been a reporter for the past 13 years, which feels like a long time when I say it, but the time's gone very, very quickly. Most of that has been spent working as a crime reporter or court reporter, and I have covered some of Melbourne's most notorious trials over that time, things like the death and funeral of underworld figure Carl Williams. I covered what I still believe to be the most brutal murder Melbourne's seen, which was the death of Renee Lau in 2014, the murder of Jill Maher, which of course made headlines right across the country. All these sorts of crimes. And I must say, when I was covering them, it never occurred to me that I would sort of take inspiration, you know, from those proceedings and put them into a book. But once I really sat down and started to write this, it made sense to me that I did actually rely on some of those experiences and some of that, you know, firsthand courtroom experience, particularly to really tell this story that I wanted to. And Sticks and Stones is, of course, fiction. But there is definitely a sense of it could have happened. It probably has happened in some form or another. And certainly I feel very much like I know all the characters intimately from my own experience over the past 13 years.
Mm. Yeah. How closely or how deeply do you have to go into the whole scenario and the people involved when you're reporting on crimes like that?
Well, the thing is, it really is a case, particularly with the sort of news I do. Right now I'm working in TV, so I do often feel like I only really get to skim the surface in terms of what I tell the general public. News packages these days are really only about a minute 20 or a minute 30 long. So when you've sat through hours of testimony in court, and often that's days after days after days, to condense it all to a minute 20 or a minute 30, you really only end up with the tip of the iceberg. You really don't get to tell the full story. But I am so drawn into these cases that I must say I quite often make a habit at the end of court cases. I apply for all the information I can, even if I know I don't actually need it for my news story. Because one of the things I do find fascinating is looking back through those court documents and looking at how particularly the offender has ended up where they have. Quite often you get quite detailed information about their childhood or their backstory. You can get medical records sometimes. You can get information on the victims that isn't always made public through the actual court process. And it's something that I find really fascinating is this idea of almost that sliding doors moment. How did everyone end up in this place at this one time?
Yeah, which of course is a great backbone for fiction, isn't it? You know, for really investigating in your character's backstory and then showing how that plays out in the present and the future as the story goes on.
Absolutely. And for those people who haven't had a chance to read Sticks and Stones yet, I have chosen to tell it through multiple perspectives. So I really did want that idea, as you just said, of those different narratives to come through. I think one of the things that has really struck me over the years is that crime doesn't discriminate. And it does impact people from all different walks of life. And in Sticks and Stones, I do have characters that come from very different backgrounds. They're different ages, different ethnicities. They have very different experiences, but they're all impacted in some way by the crimes in this book. Mm. And that's something that I do find on a day-to-day basis in court, is that it's quite incredible the different faces you get in the room. You have people who've been through the court system their entire life and they don't know anything different. And then you have people on the other end of the spectrum who really look like deers in headlights when they're there sort of thinking, how did I end up here? And it's just such a fascinating mix of people, and it's something I did want to really bring into my book.
Yeah, yeah, that is really, you do see all facets, I imagine, in that day-to-day, you know, spending all that time in the courtroom. So how did you said you worked for about 5 years on Sticks and Stones. Can you remember the moment when, or the time period when you thought, okay, it's time for me to sit down and write a novel using some of this experience?
Yeah, well, I really did start on it. It was definitely a good 5 years ago, but it was in the past sort of 24 months, I would say, when I really sat down and thought, look, if I'm serious about this, I need to get my bum in the chair and actually really start getting the words on the page and make this a real priority. It's very tough in my job, as I'm sure it is for a lot of different jobs, that working as a reporter is not a 9-to-5 job. It's not even a Monday to Friday job. So getting that routine and structure of writing, which people always tell you is important, is very difficult in my job. So I really just had to learn to be disciplined and sneak whatever bits of time I could to get the words down. Sometimes I was even coming back from a crime scene out in regional Victoria and I'd have my laptop on my lap as the cameraman would be driving, and I'd just quickly try and get, you know, 20 minutes of work done or something. It really was a matter of just saying, okay, this is a priority and I need to somehow find the time to get it done.
And did it come fairly naturally to you, you know, writing sort of a long form prose work?
It's funny, when I started out, I thought it was going to be a lot easier than it was. I think perhaps I was a little bit naive or even arrogant, thinking that because I work in media and I'm used to writing and I'm used to writing under pressure with very tight deadlines, that I would find this process perhaps a bit easier than other people. In many ways, I think I probably got a bit of a wake-up call and had to really almost start again with the process of creative writing, because it's very different. And to flesh out a book that, I mean, my book's a bit over 100,000 words, to flesh that out and to keep it interesting and entertaining and to, you know, keep it relevant the whole way through is a real skill that we don't necessarily have when we're just trying to really cut information out and squash whatever we have left into a minute 20. It's very, very different. So it was a bit humbling and it was a little bit of a, I'm actually going to have to go back and really put a lot of work into this. And there was a lot of rewriting. I actually drafted the book 7 full times, top to bottom, before I even got it to an agent. So it didn't come naturally, as it turned out.
Yeah, it's all in the rewriting and in the revision, yeah. Did you find that your experience as a journalist, where you, I know you were working in television, but I imagine you've got print background as well, where you really have to condense the story down, did that help you in the revision side of the process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things that I probably did have an advantage on perhaps other people is that I'm not overly precious about my words. I am used to having people, editors, bosses, whoever it is, tell me that, no, that has to go. We don't like that. Drop this. That's not good enough. All that sort of quite firm feedback that you do get in it.
Can be quite difficult to start with, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm very used to people telling me, no, that sucks, get rid of it, basically. So I'm quite a ruthless editor and I've got no issue. When I went through the actual editing process with Penguin, my editor there, Bev, actually said, gee, you take feedback so well. And I said, it does not bother me. If you tell me to lose a character, they're gone. That doesn't bother me at all, you know. So I think there was that benefit. But certainly, as I mentioned, the creative writing, the skill of creative writing was still a challenge for me.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk a bit about the book itself. It's obviously from the prologue, we've got a killer at the beginning that we're introduced to, and you did say it was multiple point of view narrative. Can you tell us like what the story is about and who are some of the characters who are telling the story?
Sure. So it is a crime thriller. It's set in Melbourne. It follows my lead detective, Emmett Corbin, who's head of the missing persons unit. And when we first meet him, he's feeling quite bored, I guess you'd say, uninspired with the role he's taken on. And he's surprised by how under-resourced and understaffed this unit is. And he feels like he's really left swamped with these quite banal cases, which he thinks local stations should be handling themselves. But then he comes across this case of a missing mum. And this is when things really change for him, because he quickly learns that this mum left her 2 children at a holiday program and never returned to pick them up. All his conversations with her loved ones and family describe her as being absolutely devoted to her kids. And this is completely out of character. So it does appear to be extremely suspicious right from the start. But he doesn't have to do too much digging before he discovers that this woman's family, and indeed herself, has been keeping some pretty big secrets. And so we really do see Emmett go from one end of the spectrum to the other, from being a little bit bored and wondering if he's made a mistake taking on this job, just suddenly finding himself absolutely run off his feet and chasing this really dangerous predator through the streets of Melbourne.
And so obviously we're going to have Emmett's viewpoint. Who are some of the other characters who tell part of the story?
We also hear from Emmett's wife, Cindy. In fact, she's the first character that we're introduced to in this book. I really like the idea of showing my lead detective as a family guy and having someone who does have a lot else going on outside his job. Quite often at the moment, I feel like crime thrillers use a protagonist that has a bit of a chip on their shoulder, or they have some deep, dark secret, or they have something else going on. I've gone really the other way, where we have quite a family guy at the center of the action, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't have his own problems and issues going on just in his day-to-day life. And we do hear from his wife, Cindy, who's also trying to establish her own career, which is quite separate to his. They have a young child. They have all the usual issues of who's going to pick him up from school, who's going to do this, who's going to do that. I think a lot of people can relate to that. And it really, I wanted to have that normality in the book at the same time that we have all these hideous crimes going on around us, because that is how crime operates. It does operate often right in front of our faces and we don't even notice it's going on. You know, it's the guy putting his bins out at the end of the driveway who's also got a body buried in the backyard. Yeah. You know, it's that kind of stuff. And I find that really interesting. So I really did want to show dark and light and different sort of shades of that suburban normalcy and also the real creepy hidden underworld that's going on.
Well, the prologue, we are in the killer's perspective in that prologue, and there's a certain, it's interesting when I was listening to you read it actually, there's that sort of detachment, you know, from what is actually happening. I mean, it's his mother in the bathtub and, you know, it's quite a gruesome scene, but it's told in quite a detached way because we are in his point of view. How did you go about capturing the different sort of viewpoints as you told the story, you know, as it continued along?
Well, one of the things that I have found really fascinating in all my experience seeing these sorts of offenders in the courtroom and out on the street is that they quite often don't see themselves as bad people. Very rarely do they have much remorse at all. And nearly all the time, they actually feel quite righteous and they feel really hard done by and like, you know, they almost had no choice but to do whatever they've done. And so I have taken that tone with the killer. And in fact, that was my favorite perspective to write from. I really found it quite, not easy, but almost quite liberating to put that voice on, because if you approach the world in that sense of I am right and everyone else is wrong, it's quite a liberating way to think and to look and to really have that absolute black and white view of the world. Most of us don't operate like that, but it's quite a fun perspective to write from, where you are detached from what you're doing and you genuinely don't care. It's a very interesting sort of place to be, and I found that actually surprisingly quite an easy narrative to write. The other characters I feel like I've almost met along the way. Of course, again, it is absolutely fiction, but one of the benefits of being a journalist is you are on the road so much, you meet people that you would probably not come across in your day-to-day life otherwise, from all different backgrounds and circles. So all the other people that are in my book, and there are quite a few, I actually really felt like I had met them all somewhere along the way, and it wasn't hard for me to get in their head and to really see the world from their perspective. I actually really enjoyed it, and I don't know how I'm going to go writing, you know, just a one-person perspective book now, because I really love the challenge of putting myself in the mind of other people.
Yeah. And the sort of detachment, I guess, that you would have to have in your job, your day-to-day job, you know, of sitting in court and listening to some of those gruesome details that you probably have to go through. Did you find that that sort of helped in writing the book itself? You know, like I imagine that there's some scenes, you know, because we're dealing with a serial sort of killer in those situations, there's some scenes that are quite dark. Like you say, you've got the dark and light in there, but Did you find that your own experience in your day-to-day job sort of helped you push through writing some of those scenes?
You know, it's a really interesting thing you mentioned, and this was something that really surprised me when I wrote the book. My first draft was really, really graphic, and I actually didn't even recognize that it was so graphic. It was only when I showed it to other people and they went, "Oh, that's a bit much."
Right.
And it made me realize how much I have been affected by the job, that for me this was normal and this was just the way that you describe how, what happens to these people. And in fact, now you would, if you read my book now, it's most people say it's not even graphic at all. The violence is very, very minimal, and I focus much more on the psychology and the motivation of people. A lot of reviews I've seen say they like the fact that the violence is fleeting on the page when there is violence. Yeah. So I have certainly struck a much better balance, but it was almost like I needed that first draft to kind of get everything out of my head.
Yeah.
And to really sort of find, hang on, where's that line and where's the decency and where are things just becoming gratuitous for no reason? And it, yeah, it's been a really interesting process, and perhaps it was a process I needed just for my own personal growth. Yeah, it's been interesting.
Yeah, so sort of getting it all out on the page, but then like working out where to pull back and just let the reader's imagination, I guess, take over as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've certainly learned, this is my debut, so of course, hopefully I keep getting better and keep learning, but is you really don't need to tell people everything. You can let people go their own way in their heads, and you can trust the reader a bit more than I probably did in my first couple of drafts to understand what you're saying without spelling everything out for them. But certainly sitting in court, the amount of graphic detail that we hear, I mean, the evidence photos we see, none of that ever gets into the news. And so it is there in the back of my head living somewhere. And I'm sure it helps to at least get the sense of how brutal things are across, but I certainly have learned I don't need to actually literally spell it out for people.
Yeah. So once you got to the point where you thought, yeah, I've done my, you know, 7 revisions or whatever on the book, what was your next step in terms of finding a publisher?
Well, I found the whole publishing world appeared quite daunting from the outside. And people are surprised when I say that because they presume because I'm in media, I sort of have these sort of contacts, but it's very separate to the publishing world. And I certainly, like a lot of writers, probably aspiring writers out there, I found the whole process really daunting when I looked at it. And I made the decision quite early that I did not want to send my manuscript to everybody, and I didn't want to be in a slush pile and sort of just relying on a lot of chance and hope that the right person happened to pick it up and be in the right frame of mind and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
So I made the very conscious decision that I wanted to get in front of someone physically, whether that was an agent or a publisher, and have a bit of a chat. And as it turned out, I was lucky enough to meet Jacinta DeMarze, who is now my agent, during an event. And I had a little chat to her, and she read the first 3 chapters of my manuscript and straight away asked to see the rest of it. The process to actually get her as an agent was relatively easy. She pretty much signed me up on the spot. It was all
right. Yeah, she must have loved what she read. Yeah.
Yeah, she was really excited by it, which was wonderful. But then the process of getting a publisher and finding the right place to put the manuscript, that was a little bit trickier, but it was really good to know that I had someone else looking after that and I didn't have to sort of really put a lot of my time and emotional energy into worrying what the outcome was going to be.
Yeah, for sure. And how did you find the process of, you know, once you had the contract and you were in the throes of having the book get prepared for publication, how did you find the whole process of, you know, cover design? And I know the publishers do that, but were you happy with all everything that came out of that?
Yeah, I really took the view very early on that they knew a lot better than me. I was very lucky to get Penguin Random House as my publisher. They're obviously a very, very well-regarded, established publishing house. And I took the view very early on that I would just go with whatever they suggested. This is not my field of expertise. And if they said one way or another, I would just go with that. And that really made the process quite easy. I think if you have complete trust and you just say, okay, that's the cover they want, that's the title they want, that's, you know, it really didn't bother me. In fact, I loved the editing process, because I loved having someone give me very strict sort of feedback and having guidelines to work in. I found that a lot easier in some ways than when you're just on your own, kind of with no rules and no times. And it's hard, you know. I really admire people that can sit down and keep doing it with their manuscripts, because it's not easy when you have no oversight from anyone.
Yeah, for sure. It's great to have that support, isn't it? And so the book's been out for a little while now. Or how long has it been out, a month or two?
It's been out about a month, month. Yeah, it's funny, you know, the first couple of weeks just went like a whirlwind, and, you know, I had a few virtual events, I had lots of interviews, I had, you know, readers from all around contacting me, and it was so fabulous and such a kind of roller coaster that I did after the month sort of passed, I almost felt a bit flat, like, what's happening? What's going to happen next? Because it's such a build up and it's so exciting and you get such a thrill seeing it on bookstore shelves and things. I think you do naturally come down a little bit after a while.
Yeah.
But overall, I have been so lucky that people generally seem to love it and have seemed to really bought into the concept. You know, it's really scary when you're a debut and no one knows your name and you're a complete nobody and you think, what are people actually going to think? What's your average reader going to think? Because that matters a lot more to me than what a reviewer might say. Yeah. I've been really blown away by how positive the feedback has been, and also the support for local authors at the moment. I do feel like there's a bit of a groundswell that people, perhaps because of the pandemic, understand that, you know, supporting local does make a difference. So I have been amazed by how many people are prepared to take a chance on a real nobody. It's been pretty amazing.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Mm. The writing community, I think readers and publishers have all really pulled together, I think, in the last few months to, like you say, to really support the local publishing industry and to support local authors, particularly like you with books coming out during this time, which is quite difficult.
Yeah, and it has been really difficult to get, you know, that sort of natural word of mouth going, because people are just not interacting with each other on the same level that they would be normally. And so every time, you know, a reader does go to the effort to send me a message on Facebook or whatever they do, it means so much. And I've been really amazed by the support, truly. It's actually been pretty incredible.
Oh, that's lovely. So is Sticks and Stones part of a series, or is it a standalone?
Well, it can certainly be read as a standalone, but my hope was always that it would be the start of a series. And right now I am in the process of just finishing off the second book in this series, which what I hope will be the next sort of installment for Detective Emmett Corbin. He is in a slightly different role in this book, but it does continue on where we left it. So I have high hopes that will be out next year.
Are you an avid reader of crime books yourself, and if so, who do you like enjoy reading?
Yeah, well, I always loved Scandinavian crime. I must say I feel like I have been highly influenced by that style, and particularly some of those series as we're talking, like the Camilla Läckbergs of the world, where you do get to know the detectives and his family and everything else, and you feel really quite attached to them. But more recently I've been reading a lot of Australian crime. I really enjoy Candice Fox. I find all her books just so easy to read. And I mean that in a good way. They're just so entertaining and quirky and funny. And I absolutely could not write the way that she writes, but I love the almost escapism when I read her books. And I also love Benjamin Stevenson, who's a relatively new writer. He's got his second book coming out, I think it's next month. He's fabulous. I really enjoy his work. And also Chris Hammer. I find his books just fabulous. And at the moment, I must say I am trying to support Australian, and I'm trying to read a lot more Australian for the same reasons as we mentioned earlier, that it's a tough time. So it's good to support local if you can.
Yeah. And I think, you know, historically Australian crime hasn't always been that popular with crime readers. They've sort of tended to look, you know, to the overseas authors. But the last few years, as you say, we've just had a great blossoming of crime writers in Australia, crime thriller, that whole spectrum. And readers seem to be really switching onto it, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting. You know, there's always, you know, almost like a, I don't know, like a bit of a fantasy about overseas locations and, you know, reading books that are set in LA or Paris or wherever it might be. But there's also something really lovely about reading a book where you can truly relate to the actual setting. And I've really found myself enjoying that more and more recently when you have a book that's set in Brisbane or Melbourne or wherever it is, and you can actually really picture those places and also understand the nuances of the city or of the town, wherever it's set. It does actually make for a slightly different reading experience. And I think people are perhaps switching on to that a bit more now.
Yeah, yeah, no, which is wonderful. Well, good luck with it. And thank you so much for talking to us at Rights for Women and the book launch about Sticks and Stones. And we just hope it continues to sell really well for you and ready for the next instalment.
Thank you so much, Pamela. That was wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the book launch and supporting our authors. If you like what you hear, check us out at rightsforwomen.com where you can find all our regular episodes and our new book launch episodes, and help us help authors by supporting us at Patreon for just a few dollars each month. You can find out more about all of this on our website.
And don't forget to subscribe to Rights for Women wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, can you please give us a quick rating and review so other people can find us and these awesome books that authors are launching in isolation right now.
Happy reading.
This podcast episode was recorded, produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.